From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ron Suskind talks about his new book, The 1% Doctrine, a behind-the-scenes look at the Bush administration and the war on terror. It also reveals missed opportunities, small victories, and secret negotiations. It includes the story of an alleged plot to gas the New York City subway that was called off by a leader of Al-Qaeda. Also, we talk with James Hand, a country singer and songwriter from Texas. For years, he played in small-town bars, building a reputation as a local legend. At age 53, he's just released his debut album. Willie Nelson has called him the real deal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, The 1% Solution, investigates how the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policies were created and reveals some of the secret dealings as well as successes and missed opportunities in the war on terror. My guest is the author, Ron Suskind. His previous book, The Price of Power, was about former Bush administration Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. It revealed that the Bush administration started to talk about overthrowing Saddam Hussein in January 2001 at its first post-inauguration National Security Council meeting. Suskind's new book is based on interviews with many current and former officials with the CIA, FBI, White House, and NSC, and the Departments of State, Defense, and Treasury. One chapter that has made headlines is about a terrorist cell in America that was allegedly planning a gas attack on the New York City subway. Suskind says the attack was called off by a leader of Al-Qaeda.
What happens here is that essentially in early 2003, several things happen quickly in a row. One is that by virtue of some arrests we make in Bahrain, we find that Al-Qaeda has invented a device called a Mubtaker. The key is hydrogen cyanide. That's the deadly gas, which has a long history. The Nazis used it. It's called Zyklon B, I suppose, in the gas chambers. And Al-Qaeda and other terrorists around the world have been trying, essentially, for years to figure out a way to deliver it. Well, what they came up with was this device called the Mubtaker, which is an elegant, portable delivery system. It's sort of like two mason jars together in a little paint can, I think is the best way to put it, between the two jars, one of which has, let's say, sodium chloride, the other some hydrogen substance, hydrochloric acid or whatnot, and then in between a sort of triggering catalytic element that a seal that can be broken with a cell phone, just like the other bombs, that mixes these two liquids quickly and sends out a fairly potent cloud of the deadly gas. This Mubtaker comes to our attention, and it causes something just short of panic inside of the CIA. A model is built and brought to the president, and he is, startled. Now, that's the first step. The second step is that we don't know what they may or may not do here, and we tap an inside source inside of Al-Qaeda management. He's linked to them. Up to now, Terry, no one has felt just publicly that we've had a human intelligence source connected in tight to the Al-Qaeda leadership. We do, in fact, and I call him Ali.
We do, or
the
we
book.
Did. The impression I got from your book is that we no longer have him.
Yeah, we no longer have. We sort of decommissioned him in early 2005, late 2004, because we were afraid he might get revealed by his assistance for us. But at this point, we turned to Ali. He had done good things for the U.S. government for a few months. Everything he had said had been reliable, had tracked. So we go to him and we say, what do you know about this Mubtaker idea? And he says, well, actually quite a bit. And he tells us a startling thing. He says, in fact, there is a Saudi leader of Al-Qaeda who recently met with Zawahiri about an operational WMD cell in the United States that in the fall of 2002 through early 2003 cased the New York City subway systems with the intention of using a Mubtaker device, maybe several devices, and that 45 days away from zero hour, Zawahiri called them off. The key is not called them back, but called them off. This information that gets passed to the CIA and right, of course, to the Oval Office and the Situation Room, it's just a startling moment because essentially it gives us our first real clue into the key questions as to what Al-Qaeda is really thinking.
What are some of the possible ways of interpreting why Zawahiri, the number two in Al-Qaeda, called off this planned attack against the New York subways?
Well, that, of course, becomes the fierce debate inside of the U.S. government at the very top. Obviously, the president, the vice president, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, everybody. There are a variety of positions at the start. One is that maybe he called it off because we're putting, effective pressure on the Al-Qaeda structure at this point. Some people felt that. That, though, was, I think, overwhelmed by another sort of counter-argument. The question of, is that because this, this thing, you know, my God, Muptakers in the New York City subways could cause potentially thousands of death, that wouldn't be enough of a second wave. That's the key term. What is the second wave strategy? Meaning that would not be sufficient to what Al-Qaeda is actually planning and wanting for an attack after 9/11, the second wave attack. The view now is that, A, the passage of time without a follow-up attack after 9/11 should not give anyone confidence that some sort of victory has been won. You know, in some ways, Al-Qaeda thinks in long terms, in decades, longer. We think in news cycles. We have a country with attentional issues, let's just say. In some ways, it's clear they're counting on that. They're counting on us feeling self-satisfied and successful, maybe dropping our guard, maybe just not seeing the thing that's coming. Because the key, in terms of what the most informed people in the U.S. government feel, is that the second wave, the next attack, will be bigger than 9/11. That's the idea. So that it creates an upward arc of terror and anticipation between the second and whatever follows that. You know, fear and terror without, you know, the kind of handle of real knowledge is, of course, what Al-Qaeda is all about.
Well, in your book, you say that U.S. officials' assessment is that the homeland is indefensible and Al-Qaeda is going to attack at a time of its own choosing. What leads you to that conclusion? I mean, what were you hearing about that?
Well, you know, I found virtually no one, and I talked to just about everyone under the sun with direct knowledge of the United States position, its strategy in the war on terror. Virtually nobody believes that, in fact, the porous borders of the United States are truly defendable against an ardent and targeted arrival attack by Al-Qaeda. A variety of things came up in the research for the book that, you know, frankly, were bracing for me. I live in Washington. I've got my wife, my kids. You know, I said at one point, geez, you know, I know almost nothing about the war on terror, really. I know what the official speak is, what I'm hearing. But, you know, there must be more, and God knows there's so much more. You know, the fact is, Terry, is that the idea that we can protect America is probably as much posture as it is reality, and it's a posture that clearly Al-Qaeda, you know, doesn't buy. And they're probably right to not buy it. That's what the research shows.
Is this a good thing, you telling Americans that our government thinks that our borders are indefensible?
Well, you know, the guiding principle of this book is that the American people should know now, 5 years almost since 9/11, what Al-Qaeda certainly knows and in many cases has already responded to in terms of their strategic posture. You know, the dilemma of this war on terror is that it's a war fought in secret. You know, that's a conflict that creates a new kind of tension for us here in this country in a democracy. And a guiding principle of this project from the very start is that this book will contain disclosures, things, information that Al-Qaeda already knows and in many cases has already responded to in its strategies. At some point, and there are people in the government who cooperated at various levels who I think believe this as well. They do believe it. They were asked many, many times, is this something that will somehow be dropping a card in our hand in terms of this global game of cat and mouse, of kill or be killed? And in every single case, they said, no, it's not.
My guest is Ron Suskind. His new book is called The 1% Doctrine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Suskind. His new book is called The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Let's get to the 1% Doctrine, which is the title of your book. Why don't you explain? I mean, was it officially called a doctrine before you described it as a doctrine, and what is it?
Well, some people in the government call it a rule, a 1% rule. A few have used the word doctrine. It's really the guiding principle. Again, not disclosed at this point, but it truly is the centerpiece of the United States playbook in this war on terror. And the genesis of it, interestingly, is shown as though you're sort of walking in the shoes of the participants in the book. And I think that's important to show how they arrive at this idea. And it's from a meeting in November 2001 where the vice president is being briefed about the most dire threat at that point, which is disclosures that Pakistani nuclear scientists had met with bin Laden and Zawahiri. Apparently offered them clues as to how to build nuclear weapons. Cheney's being briefed on this in the Situation Room. There are folks from the NSC and the CIA there as well. And as it starts, he sort of stops the proceedings and he says, you know, we need to think in a different way about these low probability, high impact events. And then he stops, and the briefing continues, and it's a harrowing briefing. I mean, it's just 2 months after 9/11. We're worried about a second wave attack. This is really the shared nightmare. And then he stops it, and he says, look, if there is a 1% chance that Al-Qaeda can get its hands on WMD, we need to treat it as a certainty. It's not about our analysis or the preponderance of evidence. It's about our response. That's the key. The key thing in that second part is it's not about our analysis, it's about our response. We are never going to be able to essentially abide by the evidentiary rules of analysis, of search and find, in this kind of effort. It's about action. Action even if we have just a 1% suspicion.
Well, what are some of the potential problems that you see with that policy?
Well, you know, the potential problems is that everything merits a to-be-sure response by the awesome powers of the U.S. government. And when those responses may not be justified, like the sweeping up of lots of folks with Arab names or the capturing and rendition of people who may have very, very little inclination or evidence that is pertinent to us, certainly many of the excesses we've seen in terms of torture. All of those fall into this category. As well, frankly, much of the debate as to Iraq and WMD, you know, on the outside, in public, we were arguing about evidence. Is there evidence? Is there not evidence? Internally, though, many of the folks said, you know, evidence is beside the point. We've already sort of given up our belief that evidence is really going to matter deep down.
Did people in the FBI or CIA complain to you about this 1% doctrine? Did they complain to you that it made it difficult for them to focus on the most serious of plots?
Well, of course. You know, that is part of the difficulty. What if it's 10 1% threats? What if it's 100? What if it's 1,000? What A does that mean for the capacities or resources of this U.S. government? What does it mean in terms of the people who might be bruised or worse in us, essentially saying, better safe than sorry, you know, you now are under arrest, or your phone line is tapped, or all manner of things that essentially, look, evidence is at the key of so much of what we call age of reason and enlightenment ideals that essentially are the foundation of a democracy and certainly of this country. This is loosing us from those moorings.
If people in the Bush administration and in our intelligence agencies believe, as you report they believe, that another attack is inevitable, then what's wrong with a 1% doctrine in which a 1% threshold of a plot is enough to try to investigate it?
There is nothing inherently wrong or right about the 1% doctrine. What people are going to do is argue about it. You know, on one side, you have the issue of essentially a separation, a divorcing of action from analysis and evidence, and we know the perils of that. On the other hand, those who say yes, and will say yes, Dick Cheney, go forward, are going to say, is this really the best we can do in this era to create a strategy for a war that's probably going to go on right up to the lives of our grandkids? That's a debate, and it's one that's clearly unfurling and will unfurl because of the book over time, you know, from here going forward.
One of the things under investigation now is how telephone companies have cooperated with the National Security Agency and have handed over records that allow the NSA to see who's calling who. You found that there's a corporation called the First Data Corporation that actually offered to help on the war on terror in any way it could. You say they're one of the world's largest processors of credit card transactions, and they own Western Union. So what have they done in their attempt to cooperate with the Bush administration on the war on terror?
Well, one of the great controversies is the union between the U.S. government and these large companies. It's very controversial. It does create a crossing of key lines in American life. These companies are often brand names around the world, as well as here in America. We know about the telecom companies. Here is the first instance where we basically see the other half, is that this giant global net, this matrix that they built after 9/11, sort of as a communications head and a financial body. It's this giant terrorist-catching machine. And on the financial side, the lead player was a First Data, which is this credit card processing giant, owns Western Union. They approached the government a few days after 9/11, and FBI managed that relationship. Many of the sweeps where thousands of Muslim men were swept up or interrogated around the country in the year, 2 years after 9/11, were driven under the surface by the financial information, which does tell you an awful lot. Not that the NSA stuff doesn't get you started, but the financial information tells you pretty much everything you'd want to know. And First Data was really running that show. I mean, FBI and First Data set up a kind of outlocation near a big First Data processing center so they could work together and essentially tap into the First Data giant mainframes. And then it gets even more interesting as Western Union, which is early on identified as maybe the gem inside of First Data. They have thousands of offices around the world. They're run by folks who are largely independent. Western Union is used by the 9/11 hijackers to move money. Western Union takes a step into, I think, a whole nother realm. What they do is as they're being passed from FBI to CIA, they set up a kind of wire transfer trap whereby a bit of information would be offered to Western Union. They would, through a process where it's papered, meaning they go through a Justice Department office. And essentially, Western Union knows someone is about to send a wire transfer. The key is who picks it up. And they also then can trace who's picking it up and then give it in real time to folks in the intelligence community. In the case in the book, they essentially offer this information to Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence bureau, and it changed the balance of power on the West Bank. And the big question is, should U.S. companies be doing this? U.S. companies with huge sort of communities of customers who, frankly, are unwitting. They don't know. Is it better that they not know? Is it better that the brand names of America, Fortune 100 companies, Fortune 500 companies, are in these sort of secret arrangements with the United States governments, the United States government and ultimately governments around the world?
What kind of controversies do you expect to be involved in now? And do you think terrorists are wondering what you know? Do you think people in the administration are wondering what you know? And, you know, what kind of whirlwind are you expecting to be caught up in now?
Well, you know, it's hard to gauge what's gonna happen or what will follow. The administration's known about the book pretty much from the start. There are people in the administration who were helpful, frankly, obviously many who are not in the administration. You know, I can firmly state, if anyone from the jihadist community is listening, that everything I know is in the book, that there is nothing pertinent held back. And I think that ultimately people recognize that. You know, it's a very tricky time to be a journalist and to be involved in this kind of reporting in this area. You know, I think, though, that's part of what we're facing in terms of these struggles. You know, how do you do what you need to do in a democracy so that there is informed consent? So people essentially are empowered by knowledge rather than simply fear that is rooted in ignorance or, my God, I know what's out there, but I can't know too much. I think people are strengthened by it. And I think that that America has shown that in the past and will have to show it in new ways in the future.
Ron Suskind, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Terry. It's been lovely.
Ron Suskind is the author of The 1% Doctrine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start July 10th at capella.edu. From Warner Home Video, presenting the film Syriana, Where Oil Collides with Terrorism, on DVD now, and starring George Clooney, Matt Damon, and Jeffrey Wright. And audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I drink too much. I'm too proud. I'm an easy touch and I'm too dang loud. I do a lot of things that I ought not do.
Coming up, a country singer Willie Nelson calls the real deal. We meet James Hand, a singer and songwriter from Texas who's mostly played small bars. At the age of 53, he's just released his first album.
Nothing new. You know, I ain't never asked for a lot, and that's about all that I ever got. But there's one thing that I sure would like to see. When I cash in my final chip and they lay me down from my last trip, here's the words that I want written over me. And they're gonna say, here lies a good old boy who loved life and enjoyed every moment that life had to give. You know, a friend, no matter what kind of shape they might have been in, here lies a good old boy who loved to laugh and live.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's good to have a reference when people don't know who you are, so I'll start by mentioning that Willie Nelson has called my guest James Hand the real deal. The 53-year-old country singer and songwriter has performed mostly in local bars near the small town in Texas where he lives. But now Rounder Records has released his first CD. It's called The Truth Will Set You Free. A recent review in the Austin Chronicle described Hand as singing dark, world-weary songs in a suffering wail of a voice filled with pain and wonder. Before we get to the suffering songs, let's start with something a little more upbeat. This is the opening track of James Hand's new CD.
so long I've been yearning, but I find strength in learning that she waits for me, and so deep in love are we that forever we will be on the Brazos hand in hand.
That's James Hand from his new CD, The Truth Will Set You Free. James Hand, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us about the song we just heard.
Well, the banks of the Brazos, I used to live up there on the banks of the Brazos and went with a gal that lived on the river there, and I heard it so much, I just wrote a song about it. And, you know, everyone kids me about writing three-chord country songs. Well, that one there, I don't know if I wrote it because I liked the sound of the river, because I just knew 8 or 10 chords at that particular time. But thank you for playing it.
Well, you know, James Hand, I'm certainly glad you started recording. You're in your mid-50s now, and this is your first, like, really nationally released CD. I think it's really terrific. Did you think it was too late and that your chance to have a real recording career was over before you were approached to do, right before you were approached to do this record?
That's a good question and a difficult one to answer. I don't think there's any way that I could have done what I'm doing as little as 4 years ago. And I live in mortal fear of someone telling me, you know what, James, you sang a lot better 5 years ago. Well, I might have sang better, but I certainly wasn't at peace with anything. And I'm not at much at peace with myself at any time, but I'm more so now than I was then. You know, some people say it's too late, and some people say it's too early, just as some people pray for water, some people dig a well. So it's...
Did you know that you were good? And did you know that you were good even though you didn't have, like, a real music career? Or did that kill your confidence, you know, not having albums, not performing in big venues?
Well, as a child, and this will really relay my rural upbringing, we had a cistern. I don't know if you know what a cistern is, but it catches water off the roof. And before I had any knowledge of what I was doing, I would go there and I would stick my little head in that cistern and holler, scream, you know, just so I could hear the reverb of it. And I cried as a child when I would hear certain songs and didn't even know what they were about. You know, sometimes it's like being cursed or haunted. And then it's not there, and you wonder where it went, and you pray to God to hurt again. That's how it feels to me sometimes.
What songs made you cry when you were young?
Like Green Grove the Lilacs and, you know, Tex River songs, and sometimes even classical music, you know, just hear the music. It started out, I would hear these voices in my head. And, you know, Mom and Daddy was gone rodeoing a lot, and my grandmother, she told me that it was God, and it probably was, but, you know, 7 or 8 year old, 6 year old child has a hard time comprehending that. But I know this for a fact, that she saves the Big Chief notepads I'd scribble little words and rhymes down in.
Do you remember writing your first song?
Yes, I do. I mean, the first one that really mattered anything, and it's on a previous album of mine. I wrote it when I was 15 years old in high school. We got time to do maybe a little verse of it. Here's called Merry Christmas, Darling.
Merry Christmas to you, darling. From your old used to be, did you see the card and the gift I put beneath your tree? Did you know who sent them? even though no name was signed. Merry Christmas, darling, from this broken heart of mine.
Oh, that's great. Did you have a girlfriend you were writing it to?
Well, yes, ma'am. I was 15, and Pam, I hope you're not mad at this, but they asked me things about my past.
Well, that's James Hand, and his new CD is called The Truth Will Set You Free. Now, you grew up in a really small town in Texas.
Yes, ma'am.
How small?
Everybody that lives in it can tear the phone book in half. It's about 2,500 people, I think. A little town called West. It's 90 miles south of Dallas, and it's 18 miles north of Waco, and it's right there on Interstate 35. And to really put a geographical location on where I actually live, it's about 3 miles west of West. There's a little town out there called Tokyo. And that used to be a railroad depot, but back in the war, they changed the spelling of it to T-O-K-I-O instead of T-O-K-Y-O. And that's where we, you know, my brothers, my family and I, we were raised there. And I think in the high school, there were less than 300 people in the high school. And, of course, it's grown some now, but it's still, it's a community where everybody knows everybody, and in spite of what all you hear about the gossip things and the gossip of that, It's a wonderful place, and it's like anything. It's, you know, there's always going to be roses, and there's going to be rose fertilizer. Hopefully, you walk through the rose fertilizer, you don't track it in on the carpet.
My guest is James Hand. His new CD is called The Truth Will Set You Free. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is country singer and songwriter James Hand. At the age of 53, he's just released his first CD. It's called The Truth Will Set You Free. Now, when you were growing up, your father was in the rodeo. What did he do?
He was a bareback rider, and he trained horses. And Mama, she was a barrel racer. And
did you perform in the rodeo, too?
Well, yes, ma'am. I didn't set any world. I didn't give Jim Shoulders or any of them a hard time, but my son Tracer, he was in the PBR and the PRCA, and he was in the national finals a couple 3 years in a row there.
What was your event?
My bareback riding.
Uh-huh. What has your music career been like? I know you've made a living doing several things over the years: bouncer, truck driver, horse trainer. I'm sure you've also, you know, played, you know, a lot of, you know, bars and stuff and made money,
yes,
too,
ma'am.
But it sounds like you've always needed another job to support yourself. So what was your music career like until this point? What kind of places would you play?
Well, ma'am, if I were a script writer, which I'm not, I think the life I've led would lend itself to the back of any country album, although I'm not proud of the life I've led. I don't think that anyone should talk about the bad over the good, but you're right. I have done a lot, you know, I've done a lot of other things. And at this point in my life, I explain to people, this is what I've got to do. It's not what I've got to do because I can't do anything else. It's just what I feel like that I can do better than anything else I can do. Not the best that someone else can do, but the best thing that I can do, you know, because it keeps me from going crazy, and, you know, literally. And it drives a lot of other people crazy that I don't like a lot. So that I've got a double-edged sword there, I think. But music, it is wonderful.
You know, you just said that music keeps you from going crazy, literally. You know, and earlier you said that when you were a child, you heard voices. And so I'm wondering, like, how literally do you mean? I mean, did you ever think you were literally going crazy? And did you hear voices that made you think that you were going crazy?
Well, whenever I thought I was really going crazy, I heard voices all right, but it was like, you know, the angels are, you know, saying don't do that. You know, you're a nice lady, so I'll give you a straight up answer on it. I used to see myself in the mirror turning into a werewolf. Well, I'd start praying and I'd turn back to me. Now, I'm no theologian or however you say that, but if you don't think something's right behind you that is going to do you harm, then you're wrong. And as they say, a rut is nothing but a grave with both ends kicked out of it. And you stay in it long enough and they'll get kicked in on you. I've done some things that I'm not particularly proud of. I've stepped off the page a time or two, but we all do.
Let's hear another track from your new CD. And okay. I want to play I've Got a Lot of Hiding Left to Do.
All right.
Tell us about the song.
Well, you know, a fella gets down sometimes and you just really grow ashamed of yourself. And the best way to overcome it is don't let nobody see you. And hopefully when you come back out of the woods, you look better than when you went in.
Well, this is James Hand from his new CD, The Truth Will Set You Free. And the song which he wrote is I've Got a Lot of Hiding Left to Do.
There's no way that I can stay where anyone can see what you've done after you've won another round from me. If cowards run, then call me one when pain comes sliding through. 'Cause I got a lot of hiding left to do. I've got a lot.
That's James Hand singing one of his own songs on his new CD, his debut CD, The Truth Will Set You Free. Do you go to church? And I'm wondering if you sing you know, hymns and spirituals, gospel songs.
Well, yes, ma'am. I don't go to church as often as I probably ought to, but I carry church in my heart, and when I'm out in the woods, I'm you know, I do a lot of my soul searching in solace there. And a fella asked me, I sang in church here not long ago, and a guy asked me, he said, does it bother you to sing in church when you sing in a beer joint? I said, you know what, pal, I have not walked in a building yet that I not got off my shoulder. So, and I write a lot of gospel songs. Matter of fact, there's one on the album that if I live long enough to heal, you know, if a lot of folks think it's about a man with a broken heart, but it ain't. It's about a man watching his daddy die.
Would you sing a little bit of that for us?
Well, sure. I'm getting well, I can tell day by day. God reaches down, pulls me up, and helps me along my way. He holds my hand, and I understand His love so true and real. And there is no doubt
He'll lead me out if I live long enough to heal. If I live long enough, my way won't be so rough, and then perhaps I'll be proud and strong, not always wrong, and finally to be free. Lord, I'll be straight and tall, not afraid at all, and then what can sorrow steal? And there is no doubt, He'll lead me out if I live long enough to heal.
Thank you for doing that. That's James Hand performing in the studio.
You.
And it's a song that he also sings on his new CD, which is called The Truth Will Set You Free. And it's his debut nationally released CD. You know, there's a certain haunted quality in some of your songs. And I'm wondering if that comes in part by the kind of feelings that you were just describing. And one song like that I'm thinking of is Shadows Where the Magic Was.
Mm-hmm. That, it's nearly true. I didn't stay in there. At the end of the song,
Why don't we explain? This is about somebody who goes to his old home, and now it's like surrounded by malls and stuff. But mm-hmm. but that area still has. Well, you take it from there. You explain it.
Okay. You know, I don't have to be vague about it. I did write that song, and I was in that house. And I was drunk, but I didn't stay there obviously not, or I couldn't have written a song. But
because at the end of the song, the guy burns the house down and himself with it.
And he just stays there.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably one of the absolute best songs I've ever written. Because the story of it, the way he goes and just... Every little step he takes, he knows he ain't coming back. And when you look at something and don't see a face, well, that's death. But through the grace of God and some very dear friends of mine, everything I look at now, I see a face.
What was the house that this song is about?
It was a house where It was a bad place to be.
Well, obviously this house, whatever happened there, had really strong feelings for you, and I'm glad at least you were able to get a really good haunted song out of whatever it was you were feeling there.
Well, thank you a lot.
That's right. It worked for me.
you know,
had to go through such pain.
Yeah. You know, I have people ask me all the time, I know you wrote that song about me. I said, you know what, if it makes you feel so important to be part of my misery, then I guess so, you know. But I have written some happy songs.
Well, let's hear this song. This is Shadows Where the Magic Was, and it's by James Hand from his new debut CD, The Truth Will Set You Free.
I drove to the town and I found the street and the block where we once lived. I had to make my misery complete and see if I could take what life could give. I walked to the gate now rusted and old and just about to fall. The wind grew still and my blood ran cold. There's shadows where the magic was, and there's darkness all around. Now who can tell what the devil does when he walks on haunted ground? Around the old place where my children had played, there were factories, stores, and
music from James Hand's new CD, The Truth Will Set You Free. James Hand will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
My guest is country singer and songwriter James Hand. At the age of 53, he's just released his first CD. It's called The Truth Will Set You Free. You said that you know you've taken some wrong turns in your life. Mm-hmm. I imagine one of those wrong turns, you were arrested for possessing amphetamines and spent, I think, like 9 months in prison.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Was that a really bad experience for you, or did anything good come out of that?
I'll put it like this. When I got out, I never went back. So I think that if a fellow wants to do something, he's going to do it. And if he don't want to do it, he's not going to do it. I couldn't have, I just couldn't stand to hurt my parents or my family anymore, and it never occurred to me. I mean, I read about myself all the time about drinking and drugs and all this kind of stuff, and there are people in this business that play that up. They want everybody, oh, man, I did this and I did that. Well, I want to tell you a little story about that. Everybody wants to know an outlaw, but nobody wants to be an outlaw. If a guy has got a problem, he's not going to wear it on his sleeve because he don't want anybody to know. If he's an outlaw, he's not going to tell anybody because he don't want anybody to know. The louder people say that they had a drug problem, or they went to prison, or they were an outlaw, or they did this, or the louder they say that, the less they probably did it, and the less anybody with any kind of class at all wants to hear it. Now, if someone asks me about it, I'll be forthright and honest about it, yes. But if someone doesn't ask me about it, I don't call the Rounder publicist and say, hey, guess what?
Yeah, you know, play this up.
Yeah, play this up, yeah. Because I went to prison and broke everybody's heart and my family and a lot of my best friends, you know.
You're in your mid-50s now. Your first real album has just come out. Mm-hmm. So this could be a real turning point in your life. Are there things that you want now, musically, or from the rest of your life, that you are hoping that the CD will help you achieve? I mean, are there changes that you really want to make? Are there things that you want?
If you're talking about a monetary gain, I would like to be able to do things for my family. I'd like to do things for my friends. I'd like to be somewhat of a success. And money is like 180 miles an hour on a speedometer. It's there if you need it, not just to use it all the time. But if you don't have it, then you worry about it. Now, as far as the any other success, I want to be honorable and be honorable in the eyes of everyone. And that's hard to do sometimes because we all slip on the page. Now, this CD, I think it surprised Rounder. I didn't think they thought it was going to do anything at all. And I've been very blessed by that and blessed by speaking to you. And I hope the folks understand that I ain't nothing no more than nobody else. I just want to have a chance to say something, and not everybody think I didn't do nothing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my honor.
Good luck with the CD. I really enjoyed it and enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
James Hand, his new CD is called The Truth Will Set You Free. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Schirach. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
There are times I know just who I am and what I want to be. Till a raging river climbs the dam to come crashing down on me. Then all at once I find myself in a wild and angry sea. And everything I thought I might have had left is laughing back at me. You're just an old man with an old song, a cold hand, and now your game is gone.
I can't understand what's took you so long to see you just an old man with an old song. Nothing worse than being first, unless you are the last. Standing just outside of the light, while the world keeps running past. Everything I ever dreamed I'd be now haunts me deep in the night.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA Cref, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a doctor and nurse who have treated so many gunshot wounds in one American city, they've trained medical workers preparing to go to war zones. Also, Amy Sedaris talks about her new film, Strangers with Candy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.